Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news, and we have today three of the smartest people who've both analysed the problems and come up with solutions. Charlie Savage, coming up in a moment, talking about the politicisation of the law. Then we have Paul Krugman, talking about how economic fairness can be restored to this country, and then Drew Weston talking about the use of psychology and manipulation and propaganda and how this can be countered. His book, of course, The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. I'm now speaking with Charlie Savage, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning legal affairs reporter based in Washington for the Boston Globe. Charlie Savage was featured earlier this week in the PBS Frontline documentary, Cheney's Law. He wrote an article in 2006 entitled, Bush Challenges Hundreds of Laws, which received national attention. And in the article, which also won the Pulitzer Prize, Charlie Savage showed that President Bush claimed the right to disobey over 750 laws, assuming a level of power heretofore unseen in an American president. Now, with the publication of his book, Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy, Charlie Savage greatly expands on his analysis, and he is joining us here today to expand even further on the situation. The documentary the other night on Frontline really did catalogue this usurpation of political power and the politicisation of the law. Didn't the politicisation of the law, though, in this country kind of precede Bush? This has been you can ascribe a lot of this to the goals of the Federalist Society. This has been going on for some time, has it not?
Hi. Well, thanks. Let me begin by just saying thanks for having me on and putting a little attention onto this book. As far as the deeper history of this, let me just sort of briefly explain kind of what the book does, and then I'll sort of get to your question by way of explaining that. So the book is about basically the many, many different ways in which the Bush administration has seized greater power for the presidency over the last 6 or 7 years, not just for themselves to wield, but for all future presidents, be they Republicans or Democrats, a sort of permanent reshaping of American democracy with the White House having much more unfettered discretion in all kinds of ways. And you talked about the signing statements, but they've in general established a right to bypass laws at the president's discretion or ratified treaties, especially in national security. They've established that a president doesn't need to go to the Senate anymore to pull out of a treaty to see if the Senate wants to de-ratify it. They've put White House lawyers who share this very aggressive ideology on the Supreme Court, John Roberts and Sam Alito. They've centralized much greater control over the bureaucracy and so forth and so on. And so the argument is that things have moved dramatically over the last 6 or 7 years, and that this is going to be with us for in many political fights going forward that we can't even conceive of what those will be over now. But the history, trying to explain why this has happened, you have to look back, and you're absolutely right. The story doesn't start on January 20th, 2001, when Bush and Cheney are sworn in. It really starts, in a sense, 30 years earlier, in the right after Richard Nixon fell at the in the Watergate scandal and at the end of the Vietnam War. It was the end of the period of what the historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. called the imperial presidency, which was a growth of presidential power in the context of the Cold War, beginning with Harry Truman and sort of accelerating through Lyndon Johnson and peaking with Richard Nixon, in which the founder's system of checks and balances and separation of powers and no one wielding concentrated government power had really gotten lost. And at that moment, right after Nixon falls, Congress wakes up. They began performing real oversight for the first time in 20 years, especially on intelligence, and they began passing a series of laws intended to prevent presidents from abusing their power in the future. They call them framework statutes. You can still do these things, but you have to do them in a certain way so that you only do them for the right reasons. Like you can still wiretap, but you've got to get a warrant, et cetera. And that's the moment in which Dick Cheney, now the vice president, of course, was getting his education of politics as the chief of staff in the White House to Gerald Ford, Nixon's successor. the youngest chief of staff in American history in the White House. And he was enraged by these changes, and he wanted to roll them back. And he didn't have success then, but he would spend over the next 30 years trying to restore presidential power to the sort of unchecked level that it had briefly, aberrationally reached under Nixon. And so he wasn't the only one. He's become the most important one, but there's a faction arose within the Republican Party after that moment, which agreed that these changes were bad, or this rebalancing was bad, and they abandoned that traditional conservative suspicion of concentrated government authority, and they would spend the next 30 years trying to achieve what this administration has achieved. And you named the Federalist Society. That the Reagan years in which the Federalist Society was created in 1981, and especially the legal theories that were developed by Reagan's attorney general in his second term, or the lawyers working for him, who were often Federalist Society members in the Meese Justice Department, were sort of laying the groundwork for what has been this very successfully implemented policy today that we're now seeing.
But, of course, if you go back to the Founding Fathers, which the Federalist people and most of the conservatives of the Bork school, if you will, that talk about original intent and talk of the Constitution as a document frozen in time that's still entirely relevant, almost as in the way that evangelicals and fundamentalists talk about the literal truth in the Bible, The literal truth in the Constitution was that the Founding Fathers, experiencing the capricious rule of the English king, who they rebelled against and overthrew eventually, although it was touch and go for many years after that, whether the revolution would succeed. But nevertheless, they were driven so much by the anathema of royalism. And one of the first things that they wanted to make sure is the most important thing of all is declaration of war, which they made sure that the Congress had the right to declare war. And this seems to, and if you look at the New York Times just on Saturday, the editorial with Democrats like these, the heading for the editorial is, it's castigating the opposition in this country for not defending the rights of citizens against this extension of the wiretapping claims that the president has, and apparently the people like Jay Rockefeller are being rolled. He's in there to defend the loyal opposition, and he's actually in the majority now, and he's getting rolled. So
I think what you were getting at was, this is supposed to be, the conservative legal movement is supposed to embrace originalism, that the meaning of the Constitution or amendments can't change over time just because judges decide to reinterpret it in light of changing circumstances, that's undemocratic, it means what it meant when it was enacted, and if you want to change it, you have to amend the Constitution. And that is true, this is one of the most fascinating things about this whole conversation, is that this is the great contradiction of the sort of modern conservative legal activist movement, which is that they embrace originalism when it produces the outcomes that they favor, like on social issues such as abortion rights and the death penalty. But they abandon it when it comes to executive power because they prefer, for some historically contingent reasons. There have been Republicans in the White House more than Democrats in recent cycles and so forth. They favor executive power, and that does not comport with what the founders were trying to do. That's absolutely right. The founders were, they were deathly afraid that the president might get out of control and become a king, and they set up all these checks and balances to make sure that the person who ran the government for 4 years at a time was still subject to the rule of law, that he didn't get to decide what the rules were. Congress decided what the rules were, and if he didn't like those rules, he had to persuade them to change them. He couldn't just set them aside at his own discretion. And that principle is what has been attacked so relentlessly and, I would say, successfully now. One of the things the book Takeover does is it tries to explain their legal theories and the people behind those legal theories to tell their stories and from a biographical point of view, to show kind of how they get around these internal contradictions. A very important figure on the Bush legal team is a man named John Yoo, who was a Justice Department lawyer from 2001 to 2003. He's now back at Berkeley Law School, where he's a tenured professor. And he wrote a series of secret opinions that told the president that he had the power to break laws and break treaties at his own discretion, essentially. And he had been installed before 9/11 in the place where he would be at the pressure point where he could write these opinions and decide whether or not what the government wanted to do was legal. So it's very interesting to see who he was and maybe why he was put there. He is he devoted his career to trying to paper over this problem that people who are originalists in these other respects don't want to be originalists when it comes to executive power. And he did so by arguing that in a sort of revisionist way that for 200 years everyone has misunderstood what the founders were trying to do 200 years ago, that much more than everyone realized what the founders really wanted was for the American president to be a king for 4 years at a time, especially when it comes to the war powers. And so you would say to him, well, what do you mean? Well, how can you say that? What about Congress gets to declare war? And the British king got to declare war, so how can this be the same? And his answer in his scholarship in the 90s was, well, declare is an interesting word. You know, declaring something is not quite the same thing as doing something. And then he would argue that the founders left the president with the power to commence war at his own discretion and left to Congress the power to announce, to declare that war existed if it wanted to, as sort of a diplomatic nicety. But whether or not they chose to do that had nothing to do with whether troops were actually, you know, marching forward and firing their weapons. And it's, you know, this is not a parody of the positions he was writing. It is, in fact, a literal description of it. These are the sorts of things that he was doing in his scholarship, which is not supported by just about any legal scholar who doesn't work for the White House right now. Across the political spectrum,
and not supported by the Constitution.
Well, I mean that's what I mean when I say that no one outside of the White House, you know, thinks
right.
This is correct. But what's very interesting about this and the other very aggressive legal theories that I try to explain in sort of plain English, like what is the unitary executive theory and so forth, that they've advanced, is it doesn't almost really matter anymore that mainstream scholars look at this and say this is wrong. Because they have not just asserted these theories, but for the last 7 years, they have acted on them. They've taken actions that are only legal if the theories are true. And because those actions have not been repudiated, like the warrantless wiretapping program that violates the 1978 FISA law and so forth, that means they have created historical precedents which said that those theories are true, because now future presidents can look back to this period and say, I too can do this. Why? Because of the theory of the unitary executive or whatnot. And it's not just a theory, it is a historical fact. A president can do X because a president did do X and got away with it, essentially. And so this is one of the many ways in which they very successfully left an office behind, which is going to be much stronger going forward than it was when they got there, which was their goal from their first day in office, even before 9/11.
Again, I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Charlie Savage, the author of Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. But Charlie Savage, all of what you're talking about in this and this consolidation of the unitary executive, or if you will, the usurpation of executive authority that's been taking place right under our noses here, it was all predicated upon the actions of a lunatic. That's the part of it that I find so intolerable. And I just wonder how somehow this happened without any kind of debate. I know 9/11 was a traumatic event, but the interpretation of what happened and the strategy or the lack of strategy that's followed this criminal action has meant that the president, after not knowing what to do for a few days, finally came up with, or somebody came up with the idea that we're at war, we're in a permanent war. He anointed himself as a wartime president. We didn't have to fight the war on terror, and many people think that that in fighting the war on terror, we've actually increased Bin Laden's influence rather than treat him as a criminal and deal with him as criminals are dealt with.
Is Bin Laden the one you mean when you say the actions of a lunatic?
Yes.
Okay, I was like, well, I don't entirely agree with your description there. Congress, on September 14, 2001, authorized the use of military force against the perpetrators of 9/11. And
right.
That meant that Congress, in fact, in this instance, did declare war for all intents and purposes.
Right.
This was not a self-declared thing by this Bush, this president. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that this president didn't use 9/11 to take, you know, even more aggressive action than what Congress had authorized. One of the very most interesting moments was that before Congress passed the resolution authorizing military force against 9/11 perpetrators, against Al-Qaeda essentially, the White House was lobbying them to give it a much more blank check war authorization. They were lobbying Congress to authorize the use of military force on U.S. soil and against anyone the president deemed a potential threat, not just against people linked to 9/11. And they rejected, the Congress rejected that and gave this more limited war authority. But behind closed doors, the White House, the Bush-Cheney legal team, were writing up memos that said, regardless of the fact that Congress had put these sort of fairly modest limits on this grant of war authority, it didn't matter that the president had inherent and exclusive power to do those other things, like use military force on U.S. soil and attack others who weren't connected with 9/11 if they were deemed a threat, just because he is the commander-in-chief. And so on that level, they were sort of pushing beyond. And that manifests itself in certain ways, such as deciding that he could violate the law requiring warrants for wiretapping on U.S. soil, because if U.S. soil is a battlefield now, then he has full battlefield powers, including the ability to collect battlefield intelligence as he sees fit, and therefore these laws that Congress has passed and previous presidents have signed and obeyed, are irrelevant.
But isn't that's the sort of underpinning, though, isn't it, Charlie? Isn't that the underpinning that we're at war? He's a wartime president. He's more the commander-in-chief than the civilian leader.
Well, I'm just saying that Congress authorized military force. You can't say that he declared this on by himself. I'd like to also point out something that I think is critical for really understanding the sweep of all of this. And that is that even though we're having this conversation in the context of a Republican administration that's been doing this, that's been very successfully ratcheting up presidential power for the long term, presidential power is not a partisan issue. And I think a lot of times when these conversations are had, people will sort of say, oh, I don't like Bush, so I agree with this, or I do like Bush, so I disagree with this. And you have to understand that Bush is going to be gone in 16 months, but the powers are still going to be there for whoever happens to be in office, 2 years from now, 10 years from now, 100 years from now. And so this greatly expanded zone of a White House that's able to do what it wants regardless of the law, that is able to keep its actions secret regardless of the law, and is able to exert much greater control over the sort of peripheral fingers of the government, which are now sort of much more controlled by levers in the White House themselves and the sort of in the executive branch bureaucracy and so forth. And these are going to be to the benefit of whoever happens to be president at any given time, which could and likely will be, for example, Hillary Rodham Clinton 2 years from now, to use for whatever her policy preferences and policy ends are. And that's why it doesn't, I say presidential power is not a partisan issue. Right now it's being used for conservative ends. It could be used for liberal ends. It could be used for whoever's in office at any given time. It's the structure of who gets to decide what the American government's going to do, what checks and limits there are that prevent the concentration of power for whoever's in office at any moment that is in play here. And I think that's just very important to understand and to emphasize in a conversation like this.
Well, I think inherent in this conversation is my dismay at the abdication of the checks and balances on the part of the Congress, which is, we've talked about declaration of war, and more recently I mentioned the Saturday op-ed in the New York Times about the Democrats rolling over on the FISA issues. again, we still don't know to this day what it was in the original authorization for the NSA to spy on American citizens that was so egregious that Ashcroft, Comey, and all these people, including the FBI director, were prepared to quit.
Right.
And that forced the president to modify and to bring it into law. But it for a couple of years prior to that, we still don't know what they were doing, and we still don't know the extent of the invasion of the Fourth Amendment. So this to me is, you know, I wish that there was somebody out there advocating more vigorously for the rights of citizens.
Yes, you know, when you're talking about the Democrats and the Congress's sort of failure to push back, I think this gets at something that's very interesting in sort of understanding what's been happening. The last chapter of my book is called The Politics of Presidential Power, and in it I try to sort of, having gone through and described Dick Cheney's personal history and the sort of attempt over 30 years through the end of the Clinton administration to build to this moment, and then describing in all of a myriad of different ways how this administration has successfully grabbed more power for the presidency. The final chapter is how were they able to do it so dramatically. So setting aside whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, I think it has been a magnificently ably implemented policy, even though they never talk about it. You know, they get hit all the time for being incompetent when it comes to Katrina or the Iraq occupation. This they did very competently. They set out to do it. They talked about it from their first day in office, and they just relentlessly, systematically achieved that vision. How is it they were able to move the ball down the field so far in just such a short amount of time to restructure American-style democracy in this way? And I think part of it is just that we had an administration that was pushing systematically to expand executive power as an end to itself. Previous presidents have tried to push it when they had some particular policy in that they wanted to achieve, like when Clinton wanted to go into the Kosovo War and didn't have permission from Congress. But he wasn't trying to knock down limits on war power per se, it's just that he wanted to go into Kosovo. This administration was trying to knock down limits on executive power per se anywhere they could, so a much stronger push than normal. But at the same time, we had no countervailing force, much fewer countervailing forces than usual. One part of that was obviously one-party control of government for the first 6 years of the administration, which set up a conflict of interest. Leaders of Congress had their own leader in the White House. They didn't want to criticize him. And the other, though, has been this atmosphere of national security crisis, a perpetual emergency that is the war on terrorism that arose after 9/11. And it's sort of structurally similar to the rise of the Cold War, I think, politically, in the 50s and the 60s, when there was this Congress kind of sat down because there was this fear that we could be annihilated at any moment, and they didn't want to question the leader, whoever the leader was, at any moment. And that has come back with a vengeance now since 9/11. And so what's been interesting this last year is now Congress is in opposition party control hands again, and although they've proven, the Democrats, that they're willing to perform oversight a little bit on things that don't have to do with national security, especially when the Republican Congress performed really no oversight at all, when it comes to pushing back against these power grabs in the name of national security, the Democratic Congress is really no more standing up for its constitutional role of deciding what the rules should be and writing the law than the Republican Congress was. By passing the Protect America Act and now moving towards making that permanent and giving retroactive immunity to companies that broke the law that Congress had written, we're seeing that it doesn't matter which party controls the Congress, that this perpetual emergency atmosphere is still with us. And probably, by the way, I keep saying, well, Hillary Clinton could be president 2 years from now. We're probably heading back towards another period of one-party rule in Washington. It's just going to be the other party. And so that's just going to accentuate this trend. I just don't see what's going to turn around this this ratcheting up of White House power and this diminishment of the other branches, this concentration of more unchecked authority in the White House, I think is a path that we're on very firmly and are going to continue down for the time being.
It's hard to understand why this branch of government would want to give up its power and perks so unilaterally, particularly given how the third branch, the judiciary, has become. You know, we've got two presidential lawyers now. One's running the Supreme Court, and the other one is tipping the balance in the Supreme Court.
Well, more than that, Antonin Scalia was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel for the for Gerald Ford, a friend of Cheney's, during that same period in which Congress was waking up again.
So. Right, and that just this week's PBS Frontline, Cheney's Law talked about revealed for the first time this hitherto barely known office had the extraordinary importance of it. Charlie Savage, I thank you so much for joining us. What would your greatest hope be for your book in terms of...
Well, you know, I think if nothing else, this topic ought to be a front and center in the upcoming election. I think the people who want to be president should be required to tell voters of what limits, if any, they would respect on their own authority before they move into the White House instead of afterwards. And I think that this is just such we're at an absolutely critical moment in the history of our Constitution and the meaning of the rule of law. And at the very least, presidents in both presidential aspiring presidents in both parties should be asked detailed questions about these things before Election Day. So I hope that the book, at the very least, you know, arms people to understand just what's in play and what the questions are to ask. And I appreciate you for giving me a little platform here to talk about the book a bit.
And thank you again for joining us, Charlie Savage.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Charlie Savage, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the book Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. I'm speaking with Paul Krugman, who is named Columnist of the Year by Editor and Publish magazine and is cited as the world's most widely read economist, writing a twice-daily column for the op-ed pages of the New York Times. He's a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University and the author and editor of 20 books and more than 200 professional journal articles. He's the recipient of the John Bates Clark Medal for the American Economic Association and his new book, The Conscience of a Liberal. And it seems to me that it leaves me, given the historical sweep of your book, it leaves me pondering why are liberals in this country on the defensive? Because it's the liberals in the modern history of this country that have done the heavy lifting. They saved capitalism under FDR. They were the first to recognize the dangers of the Nazis. Women's rights, human rights, labor rights, racial equality. All of these great issues, the liberals did the heavy lifting. The conservatives just said no. And in the case of World War II, of course, some of them were sympathetic to the Nazis, including members of President Bush's own family. So it leaves me puzzled and pondering, given the record, that the liberals are the pragmatists, really, and that the conservatives seem to be sort of caught in these atavistic fantasies of a shining city on the hill. Why be defensive?
Well, no reason to be defensive. The truth is that liberals lost a lot of political battles over the last 35 years, but the reasons are not a discredit to the liberals. It's not that they were ineffective. It's not that they did a bad job when they ran the government. And the problem is that really that the right exploited various kinds of irrational, divisive issues, and above all, race. I mean, the sad thing is that if you really want to ask when did liberalism begin its political decline in the United States, it's because it did the right thing with the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, and ever since then, it's been on the defensive politically. No good deed goes unpunished, I guess, is the story.
Well, I think when LBJ in 65, when he signed the Civil Rights Act, he said the Democrats are going to lose the South, and in fact, the Republican Party has become a white Southern party. At least it's dominated by white Southerners. But
yeah.
It seems to me the real shrinking of the left and the destruction of the legacy of FDR happened under McCarthy, where a simple canard was floated, which was that if you are in favor if you're a liberal on domestic programs, and if you're in favor of FDR's legacy domestically, you're therefore aiding and abetting a foreign enemy, the Soviet Union.
Well, yes, McCarthy certainly did that, although if you look historically, those arguments have only on occasion had traction. So, yeah, Nixon beat McGovern, but actually the Democrats even gained seats in the Senate in that election. The red baiting has always been a theme, and red baiting just, you know, transferred right over into terrorist baiting. But relatively few elections that have been decisive. I mean, when I wrote The Conscience of a Liberal, I thought that national security would be a big theme, but then I put in a lot of work reading the political science analyses, looking at the voting patterns, and it's definitely way back in second place behind race. I mean, Ronald Reagan, who's now been sanctified as the pure embodiment of conservatism, he was in fact primarily a red baiter and a race baiter through his political career.
Yes, he announced his running down in Mississippi, I recall.
That's right. He started his 1980 presidential campaign by going to Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the civil rights workers were murdered, and giving a speech about his support for states' rights. Mm-hmm. You don't get more blatant than that. Or in his previous run in 76, when he tried to get the Republican nomination, his central campaign image was the welfare queen driving her Cadillac, who never existed, but it was, again, race baiting. And the race baiting actually dominates, although Reagan was big on, you know, fighting the evil empire and all that. The more consistent theme was welfare cheats and all other ways of tacitly signaling his support for racism.
Right. In other words, to put the handcuffs on the welfare queens and take the handcuffs off the millionaires.
Yeah. This was very, very central. If you try to just parse out how the Republicans take control of Congress, what's the difference between the long period of Democratic control of the House and Republican 12-year reign? The answer is, it's entirely the switch of the South, nothing else. And it's the white Southerners won over by the final fruition of Nixon's Southern strategy. So that's the story, and that's an optimistic thing, actually, from my point of view. The Conscience of a Liberal ends up being a very upbeat book because I think those kinds of tactics are losing their force. We've become a better country.
Well, it's almost as if, as far as I know, the right side won in the Civil War, but if the South has made this comeback with its Southern values of the right to work and this kind of plantation mentality, which I think you can ascribe to President Bush, where a few people are sitting on the antebellum mansion on the veranda being served mint juleps by a uniformed black waiter, and the rest of us are toiling in the lower 40.
The funny thing is that I have no reason to believe that Bush himself is at all racist. There's no sign of that. And in fact, I don't think the people who lead the Republican Party they don't care much where or the other. They despise us all, you might say. But they use it. The goal is economic. The goal is to get rid of the estate tax, to get rid of progressive taxation generally, to dismantle the welfare state. The invocation of race issues is how you win elections. But again, that was then. Now, yeah, I think the defining moment for last year's election was Makaka in Virginia. Not because a Southern politician burst out with a racial epithet, but because even Virginia won't stand for that sort of thing anymore.
And Paul Krugman, in tracing the rise and fall of the middle class, as you do in your new book, The Conscience of a Liberal, it seems that if you look at those post-war movies like The Best Years of Our Lives, there was a real sense, and in fact there's a recent series on PBS about World War II, there's a real sense that the country was pulling together and that there was some kind of social contract in the early post-war period. Again, how much was that eviscerated by the McCarthy period? What is it that has...
Surprisingly not. I mean, I understand that you're concerned about McCarthy, and it's certainly a vile precedent. And we have to remember that Barry Goldwater has also been sanctified, was a big McCarthy backer. But, you know, the union movement remained strong right through the McCarthy period. Many of the things remained strong. It's really not until the 1970s that the right begins to take the institutions that sustained a relatively equal society apart. So it's much later in the game.
And is that through the use of religion?
Much less than you'd think. Yes, it's there, but it's less important than people imagine.
Paul Krugman, in your book, The Conscience of a Liberal, yeah, as you mentioned earlier, you're ultimately quite optimistic. You believe that a new regime could close tax loopholes for the ultra-rich and restore a progressive tax code, revitalize unions, rescue the middle class, if you will. Of course, that would be predicated upon the Democrats winning both the executive branch, increasing their majority in the Senate and the House. But they are at all-time low poll numbers, and they don't seem to have a very coherent narrative. They've been rolled on, for example, on the Blackwater hearings, etc. And in fact, on Saturday's New York Times, the editorial castigated the Democratic Party for being feckless in the face of a weak president, with Democrats like these being the title of the editorial. What gives you optimism that the Democrats are going to get a sort of spinal implant, if you will?
Well, okay, the low approval rating for Congress, to realize there's two very different kinds of disapproval. There's a small rump, the people who still approve of Bush, who disapprove of Congress because it's not on his side, and there's a much larger number of people who disapprove of Congress because it's not confronting him enough. Those people, as upset as they may justifiably be with the weakness of the Democratic leadership, are still going to vote Democratic next year. So if you try to figure out polls that generic congressional ballot, all that kind of stuff, they do suggest actually that Democrats will substantially expand their majority in the House and take a bunch of Senate seats and probably win the White House, although that's much more up for grabs. What they'll do afterwards is the question. And you do worry. They certainly have been amazingly weak on national security issues, where they continue. We've got a president who everyone who pays attention to this realizes that Bush is the best president that al-Qaeda could have hoped for, that Osama bin Laden must spend every evening thanking Allah that he had that man in the White House when he struck on 9/11. And the Democrats are still running scared. But with a change in the White House, that won't be less of an issue. And on the domestic issues, that's less clear. The Democrats have actually stood pretty well on things like the S-CHIP program, which is a good omen for the domestic policy. I do worry about corporate money. I wrote in the Times recently, and it's corporate money has swung heavily to the Democrats, which is quite amazing, and is good for election prospects, but not necessarily for post-election policy. It means that the lobbyists are trying to buy themselves seats at the table. And in Times of a Liberal, I talk about the Gilded Age, and sometimes Democrats did take the White House then, but they were always what they called at the time Bourbon Democrats. They were Democrats who were basically just as much in the pockets of the elites as the Republicans, but maybe a little less corrupt. And sure, that is my big concern is that we need to elect FDR, and we may find out that we've just elected Grover Cleveland.
Well, given that I just spoke last week with Wesley Clark, who was quite steamed up about the lack of tactics on the part of the Democrats. He felt that they were going to get smoked by George W. Bush, who would make a cosmetic troop withdrawal from Iraq in the summer to help the Republicans from their free fall, and that in fact, by concentrating on the troop issue, they were being sandbagged, that they would be much better off concentrating on the lack of strategy and the strategic black hole that we have in the Middle East, where while we've spent $1 trillion in Iraq, China has spent $1 trillion on its own economic growth and the betterment of its own people. Where does the Democrats and the left in this country get the kind of tactical ideas that the Republicans seem to have? Even though, as we know, the Republicans largely talk about irrelevant things like abortion and prayer and homosexuality and flag burning, they nevertheless. Sorry, go ahead.
I think you do need to say that the impression that the Republicans are pulling off tactical successes is largely confined to the Beltway. You looked at the Petraeus hearings, and no doubt that Democrats were not too effective in that, and there was this sort of, the Republicans won the PR war, and then the polls came out, and it turned out that the whole thing didn't move public opinion one bit. That I don't think on Iraq the Democrats are at risk of being smoked very significantly, because I think the American people, it's only a democracy that still keeps on looking for ways, keeps on imagining that Bush is going to have a bounce there. The reality is the American people hate this war. They don't care. They've tuned out in all these claims that victory is just around the corner. So it's actually a much this is not to make any brief for the Democratic leadership. I think they really screwed up. But but I don't think it matters as much as some people might say.
So Paul Krugman, are we in an alternative universe here where the Beltway dialogue that you see on television, on cable news, is that largely artificial? The sense that we talk about an ad against Petraeus and a candidate not wearing a lapel pin and all this.
Nobody cared. Nobody. Uh-huh. Nobody outside the Gang of 500 or whatever cared. It's just not on people's radar. I mean, you just can't see it, it's been a source of great frustration to me, and I think a lot of people that from the way the Sunday talk shows are run, or even from whom they invite to talk, you'd think that the center of the country was somewhere between Joe Lieberman and John McCain. But if you look at the actual what people say they think about the issues, the reality is that it's the left of the center of the country is somewhere towards the left side of the Democratic Party.
And this seems to be happening, though, and I'm gratified to hear this, in spite of the consolidation of the media in the hands of essentially Fox News is the kind of the Pravda of the Republican Party. Harry Reid's apparently waffling on the attempt to even give more away to fewer people. And you have this dysfunctional electoral system where apparently we're going to spend $3 billion to elect a president in this coming electoral season. Most of that money is taken from special interests and then turned over to these media moguls like Sumner Redstone and Rupert Murdoch.
And look, I mean, we had catastrophe in the last two presidential elections because the media pussyfooted around, the cult of even-handedness. So that I wrote this 7 years ago, I said that if Bush said that the Earth was flat, the headlines in the news media would say opinions differ on shape of planet. But it does matter clearly, but it's you can only fool people for so long. I thought it was really striking when you looked at the, for example, question, do you believe that the Bush administration deliberately misled us into war? That was a deemed unmentionable in polite company inside the Beltway for years and years. In fact, it's even now something where people start yelling if you say it. And yet the American people, the majority of the American people, reached that conclusion somewhere in early 2005, despite the fact that it was considered an unacceptable thing to say inside the Beltway.
But given that you just mentioned the Earth is flat, I mean, we have 40% of the people in this country apparently believe that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago, and you have on the red state side of this divide, this peculiar business where belief trumps facts. And that's one of the problems, it seems to me. How do you restore a fact-based universe in this country?
Well, we may idealize the past. Some of it is certainly very extreme, but these are not the old bumper stickers used to have. The moral majority is neither moral nor a majority. If you actually look at the at their ability to move votes, it's much less than advertised. In fact, they're right now in some hysterics because they're facing the risk of seeming completely irrelevant right now. So things are not as bad as they may have seemed. And there's, as I say, in Conscious the Liberal, I ended up looking at the voting data, looking at the demographic trends with increasing Latino and Asian vote in the United States. It just doesn't look as if the kind of Bible Belt thumping politics are likely to continue prevailing.
Well, just in closing then, Paul Krugman, do you believe that if indeed, as I was mentioning earlier, we have a problem in this election cycle where billions of dollars are raised and then turned over to the media moguls, and there's very little retail politics is being reduced in favor of television, What kind of financial independence do the Democrats have on Capitol Hill? I mean, I get the impression that what's happening in Washington is that they represent capital and not people, and we have to somehow
get... There's some of that.
Yeah.
There's some of that, clearly, but there's still a big difference. And remember that labor actually seems to be an increasingly powerful force within the Democratic Party, finally. It seems to be on the upswing. But sure, I mean, I very much worry that we'll have candidates who will take the progressive movement for granted and cater to the donors. And I guess the thing to do is to make it sure that they stay progressive. They try to do that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was speaking then with Paul Krugman, who was on a train from Princeton, New Jersey to New York City. That explains the noise in the background. I'm now speaking with Dr. Drew Weston, who is a author and professor of psychology at Emory University. Dr. Weston received his BA at Harvard University and MA in Social and Political Thought at the University of Sussex in England, and his PhD in Clinical Psychology from the University of Michigan. His just published book is The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of a Nation. And Drew Weston, we've started out here, we've got kind of the four horses of the apocalypse, if you will, in terms of subject matter here today. We started out with Charlie Savage talking about the usurpation of executive authority, Cheney's law, the politicization of the law. We've just had Paul Krugman talking about the economic destruction of Bush's crony capitalism and the how it's exacerbated the gulf between the rich and the poor. We're turning to you for the third subject, if you will, which is the extent to which psychological and emotional manipulation has and the use of propaganda has allowed the conservatives in this country to seize the patriot high ground and maintain a government where, extraordinarily, they don't ever discuss anything that's real. Everything that comes out of them, and you watch the Republican candidates for president, there's not one iota of substance in anything that they discuss. It's always somehow ends up being talked about God, prayer in school, flag burning, gay marriage, abortion. How is it this is the only country in the Western world on the state of the on the face of this earth where irrelevant issues dominate and at the expense of real serious discussions and debates upon the real challenges that face us?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. You know, just in answer to your question, when you've got one side that really gets how to evoke emotion and the other side that really doesn't and that gets terrified of the side that does, you end up in a really precarious situation. And I think that's where we find ourselves now.
But why, why is it that, is there anything inherent to the culture and history of this country that social issues that are better addressed at the pulpit have become the centerpiece in the parliament?
It's a great question, and you know, it's our country has always had an uneasy relation between church and state. I mean, it did at the very beginning. If you read Jefferson, and Jefferson was the most eloquent about it, but even George Washington, who himself was always He was always somewhat apologetic about the fact that, remarkably, he did not have a college education, unlike the others of the founders. If you read what they had to say about church and state, they understood in a very visceral way what it meant when someone tried to impose their religious interpretations of Scripture on you, and particularly when they tried to justify using the instruments of state to do that. So, many people believe that the Bill of Rights emerged as a response to things like the.
Drew, you're back with us.
I'm back. Our phone lines just went out here for some reason.
Yeah, well, I understand you've got no water in Atlanta, and now the phones are falling apart.
Well, you know, the water in Atlanta is actually a great example of you know, just what you're talking about, of how how we've been fiddling with who killed Chandra and the runaway bride while the infrastructure burns. I mean, no one here in Atlanta heard about this until just a few days ago when we heard that we've got less than 90 days left of water for a city of 4 million people.
Well, you know everything about Britney Spears' hot pants, but nothing's coming out of the tap.
It's funny sometimes when I'm speaking, doing interviews on television or radio. Now my phone line seems to work. When I'm doing interviews on radio or television for Australia or somewhere in Western Europe, I'll often say that they'll ask me, well, how do you think this applies to our government here? And I'll say, the analysis of the role of emotion. And I'll say, unfortunately, with American news coverage of international affairs, when we hear about Paris, it's usually Paris Hilton, and when we hear about Britain, it's usually Britney Spears. So I'm not really competent to answer that question.
Well, it is extraordinary. Again, we were talking earlier about how it is that that a real political debate has, in fact, been diverted constantly by the pseudo-political debate that we have, which both sides, the Republicans are much more skillful at it, and the Democrats don't seem to be able to get their agenda going. I mean, I keep seeing them get rolled all the time. I believe they got rolled with the Blackwater hearings. There's nothing more scary to me than the notion that President George W. Bush has a private army. I mean, I think that there's some incredibly lethal issues involved in this, but somehow these guys that had this hearing were sort of waffling and all over the place, and then this guy's come back, Eric Prince, with a PR offensive, and people like Charlie Rose were falling all over him. It's really pathetic what's happening with the renewal of the FISA, NSA eavesdropping, Senator Rockefeller has been rolled. Harry Reid's about to give in on the further consolidation of the media, as if the media is not in more and more concentrated in so few hands. And $3 billion is going to be spent on this election cycle, most of which is going to be recycled back to Rupert Murdoch and the media moguls.
It is remarkable, I saw the movie last night, Rendition. I don't know if you've seen it. I think it just opened most places, and I wondered what would happen if there were a private showing of that movie in the Senate and House chambers to the Democratic caucuses. You know, it's about the extraordinary rendition of a man who looks and sounds just like an American, but was born in Egypt and turned out to have no connection to terrorists, but he had some phone calls from a cell phone from a terrorist on his cell phone number that could have been from someone passing a phone around. And it's a really frightening story. What's most frightening about it is that it's the true story. This particular story is fictionalized, but you read Cy Hirsch's reports on this and other people's reports, and the people who've gotten themselves $50,000-$60,000 damages from being sent to a third world country to be tortured by the United States. I mean, this isn't the America most of us grew up in, and the idea that we don't seem to have a functioning party on either side that's checking the abuses of the president, but certainly that the opposition party that's now the majority continues to to pass legislation that they know is morally wrong and is blatantly unconstitutional and stands for everything that our country has always stood against. It's a hard phenomenon to understand.
What kind of intellectual ammunition are you putting out there for people to have in combination as I'm offering here?
Well, there is I am doing work now with a number of progressive and democratic organizations to try to work with them to develop antidotes to some of this stuff and language and imagery that will make people feel as strongly what it means when our civil liberties are abridged, not by talking about habeas corpus or civil liberties, but by talking about the fact that your child now today going to Europe for 2 weeks over the summer could be picked up by any head of state of any country in the world, put in a 3x3 hole, tortured indefinitely. You'd never know where they went. You'd never know who took them. And we are the ones who set up that rule. If you said that to every parent of a college student, people would think really, really differently about things like FISA laws and habeas corpus. Or if we simply made clear to people that when we lose our rights like this, when we say that anyone in the government can listen to any of our conversations if they just deem to themselves that we might be talking about someone abroad, which is how some of these laws are actually written, that if we do those kind of things, if we torture people, then the terrorists have won. And that's language we should be using constantly, because it's the kind of language that has been used against Democrats and against anyone who spoke out against this administration for 7 years, which is, if this happens, the terrorists have won. And I think the terrorists are winning. They're destroying our Constitution slowly but surely.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Drew, for your book, The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation, with Dr. Drew Weston.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Ian. Take care.
You too. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, and Elliot Fong and Lick Duan, the assistant producers, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program is available at ianmasters.org.